Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Dr. Suzanne Briere. Briere is Associate Dean of Outreach at Cornell's ILR School and Director of the Employment and Disability Institute. She is a fellow in the American Psychological Association and chair of the Global Applied Disability Research and Information Network. She has written extensively on disability and the workplace, inclusion, and disability law. Welcome to the show, Suzanne.
Thank you.
Now, I want to know, are there ways in which your work as Associate Dean of Outreach at ILR and as Director of the Employment and Disability Institute, do they overlap in some ways?
Yes, you know, that's a great question. I am just ending a third year in this role, and each year I think I have discovered new ways to dovetail my experience and my interests in ways that are mutually advantageous. I have a lot of background in training, as well as research and teaching that applies to my broader role, but 30 plus years of experience in the disability realm, and many issues in the workplace are linked to the issues that relate to disability. An example is aging in the workforce. So it's terrific for me that I have this broader platform to explore these interests and try to bring them together.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, what got you involved in disability issues?
A combination of things. Very early on in my life, my first position was in the disability area. In my community in upstate New York, there was a psychiatric center, and my first job at age 16 was working as an attendant in the psychiatric center there. And I also have a number of family members in my extended family who are people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. I have 75 first cousins in. So
75
first cousins? Yes, I'm very pleased to say. And so many people in my broad family network were people who have disabilities. And family and both professional experiences along the line.
Yeah. Now, there was a time, and I don't think it was probably that long ago, when people with disabilities weren't even considered to be, you know, candidates for the workforce. How has all this turned around?
It's a natural progression of civil rights more broadly. You know, I think certainly people with disabilities in the last 30 years, 40 years have felt that they had a rightful place in the workplace. I think socially we've just become better positioned after addressing the issues of racial and ethnic minorities and women to take into account this particular population. And it's long overdue. We haven't done a good job previously, but it certainly is a population we need to address, given its prevalence in our midst and the increasing problems we will have with the aging demographic now.
I've heard that 1 in 15 people in the workforce have some kind of disability. That's an enormous number.
That's probably about right, but you know, when we actually survey workplaces, it's usually 5% or less. But a lot of that has to do with people not wanting to or needing to disclose. People aren't required to disclose that they have a disability, only if they need an accommodation and want to alert the employer. And many people don't need accommodations. So they're there, they're functioning absolutely productively, and but, you know, it's much more prevalent than we would think in the workplace. So we have a track record, we're just not fully exploiting.
Yeah. Do people with disabilities still feel the need to hide it in many instances?
I think some people do. I don't know. I think protect their privacy is part of it, but also protect themselves against discrimination, appropriately so. Discrimination certainly still occurs for a lot of special populations, people with disabilities included. So I think many people with disabilities are concerned about needlessly disclosing when they don't have to. There's no need for them to. But when they do, think carefully about the implications and whether or not there's a possibility of discrimination by either coworkers or supervisors who may be ill-informed about what that means.
Mm-hmm. Now, prior to the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was enacted in 1990, in what ways were people discriminating? And how has this remedied that?
Discrimination can occur, it's interesting, across the whole employment spectrum. We often think about it happening on the front end, And it indeed can. And historically, people with disabilities, if you know, might come to an interview, and as soon as it's perceived that they're in a wheelchair or perhaps has a speech impediment or maybe a visual impairment, the interest in the candidate might either very evidently or a bit more discreetly occur. Mm-hmm. And it can happen, you know, just after the employment interview, the person just never gets a call back, and disproportionately so. That's mm-hmm. when it becomes a problem. Discrimination can also occur, however, in terms of access to benefits. If there's a health care policy that might minimize the likelihood of services for a particular disability group, that's discrimination. Mm-hmm. It can be taking part in social activities like the bowling or the soccer or the baseball team, mm-hmm. access to social events, or it could be disproportionately being laid off because a person has a health or disability-related situation and first to go in the layoff process, mm-hmm. which would be discrimination.
Yeah. So did the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 change anything? How can you prove that people are being discriminated against?
You know, that's an ongoing debate among researchers, mm-hmm. and Cornell is in the heart of that. I'm both pleased to say, and also it's a dismaying at times.
Oh, yeah.
We try a whole host of different ways to measure progress because it's important to show that laws make a difference. And we look at employment rates of people with disabilities using national data sets. We look at surveys of employer policies and practices, what employers tell us have been easy to implement and difficult to implement. And when it's possible, we try to interview people with disabilities and find out what their experience has been. Mm-hmm. And so to date, I would say we know we have lots more work to do, but progress has been made. Certainly many more people are aware of their own rights, and responsible entities like employers are aware of their responsibilities in a way that they were not previously prior to the ADA.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that there's still discrimination against people with certain disabilities in regard to health insurance.
Well, that's true. There has been one area where we've seen that more predominantly is mental health coverage. There's often been a different set of rules, a different carve-out policy for mental health. That's changing now, and I think appropriately so, as we become aware of how that is discriminatory and the needs of the general population around for emotional and mental health. I think we would become more aware it's detrimental not only to the individual and discriminatory, but it's detrimental to the well-being of the employing organization. Mm-hmm. So that's changing, I'm pleased to say, yeah. But it's been slow in coming.
It has. I remember a few years ago when you couldn't run for high office if you had any kind of mental disability especially. And that seems to be changing.
It is changing.
Uh-huh. Now, you're the director of the Employment and Disability Institute. Tell us what you do exactly.
Well, this unit, under different names and different forms, has been, I'm pleased to say, in the ILR school for over 40 years. Mm. So it's terrific, I think, that a school that's devoted to workplace issues way early on, although it's evolved in focus, had some sensitivity to the importance of including these issues. It's changed over time from the application of small business best practices to the managing of sheltered workshops, which is how it started out in the late 60s and through the 70s, to looking at more integrated employment options, supported employment for people with disabilities in the 80s, to in the 90s looking at discrimination in the workplace, what employers' responsibilities were, and infusing in a lot more research. And now we're looking more at public policy, although not to the exclusion of the others, that influences youths being able to equitably access skills to compete for jobs and inclusion of people once they are hired.
Mm-hmm. How does one enforce inclusiveness? I mean, can you? Do you do trainings and try to make especially human resources departments more sensitive to these issues?
Yes, we do. And you're right to identify HR practitioners, professionals. That is certainly a constituency we've reached out to very purposely so. It's hard to know how best to permeate the workplace with information, and our choice early on was to try to use the policies and practices of human resource professionals as a way to try to change workplaces. So rather than coercion or intimidation, we've tried to use an educational approach. We feel that we'll make a much greater difference over time if we try to partner with employers and encourage them to use best practices, because it's not only in the best interests of their applicants and employees with disabilities, but their general population. When employers use these best practices, their whole workforce benefits, and I think they do as well, certainly in the longer term.
It seems like the issue really does need to have a leadership proponent to it, right? I mean, from the top down.
Absolutely. Our research supports that. When we ask our HR professionals what's the most important thing to making change, the top management support of these issues, raising its visibility, is the number one thing they tell us they need to make change.
Mm-hmm. You also have a degree in psychology. Is there a fine line between actually including people with disabilities and being patronizing?
There certainly can be.
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes people don't know how to approach a person with an obvious visible disability and may hesitate. And that's where, you know, just general education really can help out a great deal. We try to promote the sense that people should feel comfortable asking, but be sensitive in that inquiry, and in that process, get educated about what the experience of the person with disability is and what they can feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. So do they usually get people with disabilities involved in some of the conversations?
Absolutely. That's mm-hmm. the best way to do it. That really is where the better learning occurs. So wherever we can do that, we certainly try to make that they're the best spokesperson around these issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are bringing home many disabled young men and women, many who have never really even been in the workforce. How to deal with that?
Well, it certainly is a pressing problem for all of us, and I think we're recognizing it not only in the general, I think, civil society, how important it is for us to line up behind and try to assist our returning veterans, but certainly those of us in the disability community and the service delivery systems recognize that we need to prepare ourselves to be able to respond to these challenges. We have certain targeted disability groups we know we're going to need to enhance services for, and there are federal agencies like the VA working with some of our service providing organizations to create memorandums of understanding to try to be more ready in our response to these needs.
Mm-hmm. Does the Americans with Disabilities Act make it imperative for offices to accommodate disabilities and so on and actually make physical changes?
Yes. If they have an individual, they need to be sure that their application process doesn't needlessly discriminate, and that becomes ever the more challenging with, for example, more online recruiting. Web-based recruiting has created a whole host of new opportunities for people who might have difficulty getting up steps to a interview place, but also for people with visual impairments, a whole new set of barriers. So we continually try to educate around those new challenges. But once someone is in the workplace, by all means, if that person needs an accommodation to be able to do their job, especially the more extraneous and the essential pieces of that job, it is important for the employer to respond. It needs to be a reasonable request, but mm-hmm. it is the employer's responsibility to have a conversation around that and to figure out how to respond.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Suzanne Briere, Associate Dean of Outreach at Cornell's ILR School and Director of the Employment and Disability Institute. Is there a point in regard to these issues when some employers can say that somebody's too disabled to work?
Well, certainly the Americans with Disabilities Act, and in practice, I think we would all agree, if the person can't do the essential functions of the job, then it's not an appropriate job match. And I think in those situations, we see employers sometimes trying to shift the job so that the person might function effectively in a different type of position, but it may come to the decision that indeed there's not an appropriate job given the limitations that the person is experiencing. And it can happen with progressive kinds of disorders that it may happen over time that there is that juncture where decision has to be made.
But it behooves them to try to try to get these people in different positions if possible?
I think it's in everyone's best interest to retain a seasoned, loyal employee, and I think employers recognize that, and they willingly often will try to see if they can accommodate in the existing position and where not, if there might be another open position that the person might be able to be successful in transferring to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, we're seeing more and more aging workers staying in the workforce. They can't retire for whatever reason. What kind of challenges are we seeing in regard to this?
Well, there's a natural lessening of visual and hearing acuity for all of us in the aging process, as well as, you know, perhaps fine motor dexterity. We see a lot, you know, more increasing arthritis. So we certainly are going to experience these types of common aging sort of problems. And we encourage employers to think about that, to get out in front of that. There are adaptations to workstations, all kinds of computer use that technology now really can help us with minimizing, if not eliminating. So what we like to talk about is a universal design that will not only accommodate people with disabilities, but will mean that these employers don't have to lose their seasoned employees if they design their workplaces to accommodate proactively.
Mm-hmm. Is there still a mandatory retirement, or is that up to each individual organization and so on?
There is not a mandatory retirement.
Really?
So people can elect to stay in the workplace longer, and many are doing that. You know, just the economy often necessitates it, but I think people are recognizing that they feel good about being able to contribute, and they want to stay in their workplace.
And a lot of people stay in because they need the health insurance.
Yes.
And different
there
kinds
are,
of benefits
there are other
as well.
Benefits mm-hmm. incentives as well. Mm-hmm. So we are encouraging employers to think about creative ways to maximize people's productivity, keep them engaged in a win-win type of arrangement.
And how did that change? I remember there used to be mandatory retirement ages. Was that the Americans with Disabilities?
No. Other regulatory changes that have occurred. And I can't off the top of my head tell you, but I do know that that's the case. And we have, of course, age discrimination legislation, the ADEA, which operates in complement here that protects people over the age of 40. So there's a big cohort.
Which seems awfully young now, doesn't it?
It does, but it's nice to also know we have protections.
Yeah. Now, the Americans with Disability Act cannot legislate people's attitudes. So do you have little tricks or little, you know, ways of training people to at least think about changing their attitude?
You know, we certainly have worked on those kinds of things for a long time. I think we've moved as we learn, as we respond to employers' preferences. We've moved from we'd often do simulations of disability experience with people. We'd go through disability awareness training. We've moved now into more looking more broadly at workplace culture and what are the policies and practices more broadly that maximize people's feeling of inclusion, including people with disabilities. So when we look at workplaces, we look at, you know, what are the factors that make people feel like it's an equitably applied opportunity environment where job progression and career enhancement is concerned. In those types of environments, people with disabilities do better because there's a feeling that this work context really thinks about supporting individuals, but also spreading in an even-handed way opportunities, it's less likely that if someone needs an accommodation, which could appear as a special treatment, that that's seen as a problem, and it's taken as a matter of course of good business by coworkers. So we really look for those elements that are good workplaces more broadly and encourage now employers to think about disability in the context of those good practices for all of their special populations.
Mm-hmm. I would think that fear is a lot of what stops people from being able to deal with people with disabilities. And then that hasn't changed. But the culture has in some ways, right?
I think we are getting better and better at recognizing that difference doesn't need to be a problem. It can be an enriching thing. It doesn't mean it isn't challenging when we're confronted with it, but I think our experience over 30, 40 years in trying to minimize discrimination, maximize inclusion for other populations should readily translate to disability. We just haven't done as good a job of of having it be evident that that is a part of effective inclusion, and yeah. that's what we're working on.
Yeah. Now, how has the new high-tech world changed things for people with disabilities?
It's been both a tremendous boon, but also, as I began to, I mentioned in the prior example about online recruiting, it can be an impediment, but it's needlessly so. Because there are usually often technological fixes in every place where technology could be an impediment. So it's just a function of creativity and being open to exploring what the alternatives might be. Mm-hmm. People with disabilities can work at a distance now if proximity because of mobility was an issue. Certainly many of us are taking advantage of flex workplaces and flex time. Policies and practices, and people with disabilities certainly are also advantaged with those new kinds of approaches to workplaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't think of the name of it. There's a new film that just came out, and everybody's up in arms about it because they call people retards. And have you heard about that?
I'm not sure if I have.
Oh, but at any rate, I wonder what your opinion is of some of these issues. When they think it's parity in regard to people with disabilities, how is that affecting people?
I'm going to respond to two things. One is you used a term, and labeling certainly is an issue for people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. So there is a strong reaction, as there is with racial, ethnic minorities and women, to terms that are potentially insulting
and hurtful.
Mm-hmm. And certainly we should eliminate and minimize those types of exchanges with people. But also labels tend to needlessly limit the perception of the full capability with people with disabilities. And so we've really worked hard on trying to eliminate not only those terms which are clearly insulting or hurtful, but even more broadly, people with disabilities is the terminology. It's not disabled people, and that's very purposeful. Mm-hmm. It is to try to subtly send the message that people are people first, regardless of whether or not they have a disability, mm-hmm. and that's an important message to send.
Oh, absolutely. It changes attitudes. You've been in the business of disability law for many, many years. What do you think the biggest change has been? Positive change?
I think the most positive change are that people with disabilities themselves and their family members feel empowered in a way that they didn't for a good long time. And in that empowerment are themselves changing service delivery systems, changing workplaces. And I think that's for the good of all of us. Everyone's going to be touched at some point in their life by disability. So having sensitivity around us permeate our culture more is really to advantages all of us. It's led to universal design on technology, on workplaces. We're all benefited from that. But I think disability is the great leveler. It crosses, it knows no socioeconomic, no ethnic, racial, or gender distinctions. So when you look at it globally, it can be the thing that ties us all together. When we do global work, that is the point we try to make, is it can transcend where there are other distinctions. We had a great example on campus in that we brought some young people who are disability leaders from Northern Ireland and the Republic here, and their differences in religion melted away, which was their biggest distinction, as we talked about them banding together across those politically divided borders to try to make a difference for people with disabilities in their respective countries. So it can transcend some of those political issues that are ones that have divided countries for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, what do we still need to do, especially in this country, to help accommodate and teach people about disability?
Well, I think we need to put it in the common vernacular. Some of the things we're talking about now is how do we put disability in front of the general public and recognize that it's a natural part of the human condition so that people accept their coworkers, accept their neighbors, and accept their own family members who are people with disabilities and see them as capable, competent, fully functioning and participating citizens.
Mm-hmm. And are there different ways that people in different countries deal with disability? Have you done any research on that we have learned from, perhaps?
Certainly there are many countries that are passing now disability rights legislation. And in fact, We have received an enormous boon in the last year because the UN has passed a convention on the rights of people with disabilities. So there is a worldwide movement, but there is a wide spectrum of how rights are being implemented or supported in different countries. So we're working hard on trying to bring our experiences in countries that have pass legislation and move more quickly to those of our sister countries who are just the beginnings of those kinds of initiatives.
Mm-hmm. And how has working in this realm changed you in any way?
Well, I think it's made me inordinately humble. People with disabilities inspire me every day. I see people just transcend tremendous obstacles and be so successful, and I think it's just made me realize how much we have as human beings to work with and how we don't, I think, appreciate and recognize the importance of bringing all of our capabilities forward. And when you see someone do that in the face of sometimes some very significant challenges and adversities that other would, I think, make us think like we could cave in, it just tells me how important it is to support everyone in maximizing their potential, regardless of whether they have a disability or not, or any other kind of limitation.
Uh-huh. Well, Suzanne Briere, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.